Thank you, Marlon. And I am so honored and so pleased to be able to talk to you in this temple of learning, this temple of truth. I want to start with a picture of America. And what I've done is I've taken the 3,000 odd counties in the United States, and I've ordered them on the basis of their density level. Because at their hearts, cities are the absence of physical space between people. Cities are density, proximity, closeness. Now, what you can see in the bottom line, the blue line, is the relationship between density and earnings. The densest tenth of America's counties have earnings that are on average 50% higher than the least dense half of America's counties. This is something economists call agglomeration economies, the fact that we get more productive when surrounded by a maelstrom of economic activity. And it's not that we become more productive overnight. It's that people who come to cities see their wages increase year after year, month after month, because at their heart, cities are forges of human capital, places like Harvard, where we get smart by being around other smart people. Now, the top line shows the relationship between population growth and density. As you can see, it's an almost steady monotonic relationship. So whereas places at the start of the 19th century, whereas Americans were leaving their dense enclaves on the eastern seaboard to populate the empty spaces between the oceans, at the start of the 21st century, instead of spreading out, we are clustering in. We are going to the places that were already dense and just making them denser. Now, in some sense, this is a puzzle, because we live in an age in which we are told that distance is dead, in which we were told by the techno-prophets and the cyber-seers that we would all just go and disperse ourselves to electronic cottages and villages and just dial it in. And yet, we're not. Now, not so long ago, in the New York City of my youth, that would be in the 1970s, it really looked as if cities were headed for the trash heap of history, that not just President Ford, but history itself was telling New York to drop dead. And in those years, there wasn't much difference between Boston and Buffalo. Both looked like they were dying. There wasn't much difference between Detroit and Seattle, right? In 1971, two jokers put up a billboard on the highway leaving Seattle, asking the last person to leave the city to turn off the lights. Because just as no one could imagine a Detroit with a smaller General Motors, no one could imagine a Seattle with a smaller Boeing. This is before Amazon, before Microsoft, before Costco, and you know, Starbucks is just beginning to percolate some brew. But these cities did come back. Why did they come back? Why weren't the techno-prophets right? The reason is that what globalization and new technologies have done is they've radically increased the returns to human capital. They've increased the returns to skill. Because today, you can sell it on the other side of the planet, you can source it on the other side of the planet, and being an innovator, being on the cusp of new ideas, is an incredibly valuable thing. The great asset of cities at the start of the 21st century is their ability to make us smart, their ability to enable those collaborative chains of creativity that have powered humanity's greatest hits since Socrates and Plato bickered on an Athenian street corner right down to Facebook. And I'm not going to say any more about that for legal reasons. The role of cities as places of knowledge transfer explains why finance particularly loves cities, because there's no industry in which it is easier to become rich by knowing more than finance. It's an industry that has the highest returns to knowledge, and hence it loves cities. I've put up here a picture of the Wallace office at Bloomberg City Hall, which is modeled on the Wallace office at Bloomberg LLP, which is modeled on the Salomon Brothers trading floor, which Bloomberg ran in the 1970s. Now, there's something odd about trading floors, and I want you to just think about it for a second. Here we have some of the wealthiest people on the planet who, in a normal industry, would sit protected by giant oaken desks, would sit ensconced in large offices, would be protected by executive assistants. But there on a trading floor, they're all on top of each other. They're all sweating on each other. They're all getting guacamole on each other, if Michael Lewis is to be believed, right? Why are they there? Why are they putting up with that? Because knowledge is more important than space, right? And that is why cities have come back. Because what globalization and new technology have done is they've made knowledge more important than space. There are a couple of other reasons why I like this picture. One of which is it reminds us of a chain of creativity in finance. And cities have always been about these chains of creativity. So think about Renaissance Florence in the 15th century. Brunelleschi figures out the basic mathematics of linear perspective. making two-dimensional spaces seem three-dimensional. He passes it along to Donatello. That would be the sculptor, not the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. Who puts it in low-relief sculpture on the wall of Orson Michele. Right? Passes it along to Masaccio, who puts it in painting in the marvelous Brancacci Chapel. St. Peter finding the silver coin in the belly of a fish. Passes it along to Fra Filippo Lippi, that less than saintly monk. Passes it along to Botticelli and so forth. A chain of genius, each person riffing on each other, each person doing something magical. And indeed, this is the same thing that happened in New York. Right, a basic understanding of how to trade off risk and return then got carried by people like the young Fisher Black to Wall Street. This then enabled people like the young Michael Milken to convince investors that his junk bonds carried enough rewards to offset the risk. These junk bonds then enabled the young Henry Kravis to engage in larger and larger leverage buyouts and so forth. Right, a chain of brilliance. And that's very much what we hope you will be part of here. This is very much part of what a learning environment where we all borrow ideas from each other all the time is all about. Now, I want to make one other point, though, about this face-to-face contact and why it's so valuable. The world has become more complicated. Ideas have become more complicated. And anyone who's ever taught knows the hard part about teaching is not knowing your subject material. It's knowing whether or not anything you're saying is getting through. Now, we have accumulated over millions of years these cues for communicating comprehension or confusion that are lost when we're not in the same room with one another. That's what face-to-face contact means. And when you come here, as I hope all of you do, parents as well as children, of course, right, you realize that it's not faculty that make the difference, it's each other. It's the fact that you're thrown into this maelstrom of what Harvard is. You're thrown into this atmosphere in which you'll breathe the air of ideas around you. And you'll teach yourselves, and at best faculty, when we work really hard at it, manage to direct the subject of conversation. Now, the role of ideas in fueling city growth explains why some cities have done better than others. Education is the best predictor which one of America's once declining cities have done better. So if you compare Seattle to Detroit, one half of Seattle's adults have college degrees, one in eight of Detroit's adults have college degrees. They're both doing exactly as well as that those skills should predict. This shows the relationship between population growth between 2000 and 2010 and initial share of the population with a college degree. Again, strong positive relationship. Skills really are destiny at the individual level, at the city level. And the city effects get magnified. This is something economists call human capital externalities. If the share of adults in your metropolitan area with a college degree goes up by 10%, your earnings go up by about 9%, holding your years of schooling constant. It really pays to have smart people around you. Now, many of the skills that matter in cities are not those that are taught at Harvard, believe it or not. They're the skills that are learned on the streets. They are what Alfred Marshall, the great English economist, was talking about in the 19th century when he wrote that in dense clusters, the mysteries of the trade become no mystery, but are as it were in the air. There's nothing that is more important for the long-run vitality of a city than the talent and inclination to be an entrepreneur, to come up with new ideas, to seek new opportunities. If you want to, 50 years ago, the economist Ben Chinitz was comparing New York and Pittsburgh and noting that New York seemed to be more resilient than Pittsburgh was even then. He argued that this was a reflection of New York's industrial history, its focus on the garment trade, an industry with very few barriers to entry in which anyone could get started, and many of these garment entrepreneurs did totally different things. They started movie studios, they built skyscrapers, and they went on and did, you know, amazing things. By contrast, Pittsburgh had U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel trained company men. Those company men were very productive in the short run, but very bad at looking for new opportunities. And when you think about your own career here, it has to be about both skills and entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship in every level. Entrepreneurship in your social relationships, entrepreneurship in your intellectual relationships. You need to grab the opportunities that this amazing place will give you. Now, the most entrepreneurial place I've ever been is the Dharavi slum of Mumbai. Right? It is a place that is just crammed with human energy. You know, you walk down the street and there's some guys who are sewing brassieres and you think you're in the Lower East Side of Manhattan in 1907. And then across the way, there are people who are recycling boxes by chopping them up and turning them inside out. Who knew there was a living in that? And yet the city told them that. And you feel so uplifted by the energy of India, and yet you walk out into the street, right, and you see a kid defecating in an unpaved road. And you know the water isn't fit to drink and the electricity is unreliable, right? And you just feel the enormous downsides of density. Because just as there is enormous promise in the fact that the poor world has become urban, right, that more than 50% of humanity now lives in cities, there are also enormous challenges. Now, there is no future in rural poverty, but the great challenge of the 21st century is making cities like Mumbai, places like Dharavi, livable and safe and places of opportunity for all. Now, One of the great challenges with doing research on the developing world is the availability of data. Often government data, particularly in poorer parts of the world, is really quite weak. And one of the things that's really neat is that we can increasingly use private data, in this case Google Street View, to tell us about income and poverty or the presence of things like open sewers. So what I've been doing with a computer scientist who'll be here for the next couple of years is we've been using Google Street View to measure wealth and poverty. And the way this works is you need to have some survey where you actually have wealth and poverty, and then you essentially use the pixels to predict wealth. If the prediction works well, you then have a measure of wealth based on the images on the pictures, and then you can use that to map wealth and poverty throughout the entire area. It turns out, I've done this for New York, it turns out this is how good the fit is. I can predict about 80% of the variation across New York City block groups just with the pixels. And we're still working on Indonesia, we're still working on Chile, we're still working on Pakistan. Now, the cities of the West have a long history in dealing with the demons that come with density, with contagious disease, with traffic congestion, with crime, with high housing costs, right? America's cities and towns once were places of death. A boy born in New York in 1900 could expect to live 7 years less than a rural American, right? This didn't change easily. America's cities and towns were spending as much on clean water at the start of the 20th century as the federal government was spending on everything except for the post office and the army, right? It took enormous investments in infrastructure to make this work, but infrastructure is not enough, right? The great piece of infrastructure investment in New York is the famous Croton Aqueduct. You will see it's built here. It was the story that I was told when I was a child, was that, in fact, New York was unhealthy until the Croton Aqueduct brought in the clean waters of upstate, and then all of a sudden the city became healthy. Anyone see a great trend break here? Anyone see the death rates diminish immediately once those clean waters flew in? Of course not, right? 25 years later, New York is still having cholera epidemics. My five-great-grandfather died in the 1849 cholera epidemic in New York City, right? It didn't start going down until after here, until we had rules to supplement the infrastructure. And the problem was that poor people weren't connecting. They weren't using the sewers. They weren't using the water. It was what we face when my work that I do in Zambia today, but it's called the last mile problem of getting people to connect. And it wasn't until you imposed requirements on property owners to connect to the sewers, which reminds us that property is not just about empowering, it's also about creating obligations. We have the same behavioral issue in transportation. You can't just build your way out of traffic jams because something the economists Gilles Duranton and Matthew Turner have called the fundamental law of highway traffic. Vehicle miles traveled increase roughly one for one with highway miles built. If you build it, they will drive it, right? You cannot just keep on building highways and expect the problem to be solved because of the behavioral response. You need to charge people for the price of their roads. You need to have congestion pricing or some equivalent if you expect the roads to move quickly, as they do in Singapore, which is the second densest country on the world, and yet the streets move effortlessly because they charge people for the roads they use, because they charge people for the social costs of their actions. Now, cities have such promise for many reasons, but one of them is also environmental. And I want to illustrate this point with a story about a young Harvard College graduate, this could be you, right, in 1844, who went for a walk in the woods outside of Concord, Massachusetts, and he did a little fishing, and the fishing was good because there hadn't been much rain lately. And then he came to cook the fish into a chowder. That's what we do in New England, for those of you who are new here. We cook chowders all the time. And the wind flicked the flames to the nearby dry grass, and a fire started, and it spread, and it spread. And by the time it was done, it was a raging inferno that had burned up more than 300 acres of prime woodland. Whole natural ecosystem destroyed by this young man. In his own day, he was castigated as an enemy of the environment. The Concord Freeman called him a flibbertigibbet, which I think was pretty bad for 1844. And indeed, it's hard to think of any young man at that time period who did as much damage to the environment as this character did, right? Oddly, of course, today he is revered as the secular saint of American environmentalism. His name is Henry David Thoreau, and his book, Walden, teaches the moral of what a wonderful thing it is to live surrounded by nature. And yet, living around nature doesn't seem to have been so wonderful for nature, does it? You know, indeed, I take away from Thoreau's life a different moral, which is that we are a destructive species, and if you love nature, you should stay away from it, as indeed Thoreau would have done much better for the plants if he had stayed at home. Now, I experienced this personally. This actually comes from statistical work with Matthew Kahn, where we estimate the carbon emissions associated with living in different parts of the country. And the places that look brown are green, and the places that look green are brown, precisely because of much smaller apartments, living in urban spaces, and even holding income and family size constant and much longer drives. And I started to learn this personally when I began acquiring small children about 10 years ago. I moved from about here to about here, and what with the driving and the home heating, I started doing as much damage to the environment as Thoreau did. Another way of seeing this is that the great growing economy economies of India and China see their per capita carbon emissions rise to that seen in the sprawling United States, global carbon emissions go up by about 130%. If they stop at the level seen at wealthy but hyperdense Hong Kong, global carbon emissions go up by less than 30%. Now, I don't want to end on a global warming point because it seems like a downer. The larger point, and it's true of Harvard and it's true of cities, is that for centuries, for millennia, the track record of our species, when we work together, when we learn from each other, when we collaborate in urban spaces, is just amazing. Humanity together has been doing miraculous things for millennia. And that, I think, is the real lesson of the city. And thank you for your time.